Welcome to the Immigrant Stories Program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher. For 500 years, the Haitian people have struggled mightily to free themselves and their country from the tyranny of colonial and neocolonialism. First it was Spain, then was France and Britain and Germany, and finally the United States. All of these major powers took what they wanted without real regard for the people and moved on, making Haiti one of the poorest countries in the world and forcing many Haitian families to flee their homeland in search of safety and stability. My interview today is with Colorado State Representative Junie Joseph. Her parents tried for years to make a life in Haiti, but the time came when they had to leave. You came from Haiti when you were 14 years old. What memories from Haiti did you bring when you came?
Growing up in Haiti, I had a big family, a big Haitian family. In Haiti, a lot of people live intergenerationally. So I have brothers, cousins, uncles, grandma, grandpa, and mom. Everybody live in the same house or live within, sometimes a house, my mom's house had a two-story, and then there are times I would just go to my grandma's house, which is out just a little bit outside of my mother's area. So I was bouncing between my mom and my grandma's house all the time. So it was always people around. It was fun. I had uncles who were similar, almost maybe 5 to 10 years older than me, and I had cousins. So it was a big, big family. Wow. Very dynamic.
What are the special memories that you have of those family times?
People talking a lot. You know, Haiti, at least I can't speak for everywhere in Haiti. I can only speak to my neighborhood and where I grew up. There was not always electricity. And because of that, people spent a lot of time talking to each other.
Which is ideal, actually. We should do more of that these days, shouldn't we?
Yeah.
So who were the people in that special time in your life? Who were those influencers, people who guided you to where you are now?
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned to you, because I think my family was so dynamic, I think that also make me who I am and the person that I am. And, you know, to some, they might find that a bit tricky, that I think I'm a very open person as far as worldviews. I think I just see the world and meaning, for instance, in my family, we had Catholics. I was a Catholic once. I've been a Jehovah's Witness. And I've also been a Protestant. And I've had all these people in my family who are Adventist. I've had Church of Christ. I've had something similar to Mormonism in Haiti in my family. So I've seen every religion in my family. And because of that, when I meet people from various religions, it doesn't bother me. It's just part of what it means to be human. And when they say things to me, I'm like, oh, I think I've heard this before from my own family. So whatever they are saying to me doesn't sound too foreign, no matter how conservative it may be or no matter how progressive it is. I'm like, oh, I'm sure I have somebody in my family who's expressed those views. And as a child, when you hear them, I'm not shocked. So when as an adult now, when I meet people and they'll say things and I'm like, okay, that sounds familiar to me. I probably don't agree with it because of my views or my own based on my lived experience and where I am now in life. But nonetheless, I'm like, okay, I think I've heard this before.
Yeah. Diversity of thought. What an idea.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. I mean, and the thing too, like, as I mentioned in my family, people would sit around, you know, on Saturdays and Sundays sit around and talk about different religions. And they would have those open debates about, I don't agree with your religion. I don't agree with this practice or this ritual of your religion. And they would just debate it right in front of me. And I think those debates to me was very white, you know, it was eye-opening.
Yes. But I can see where that early training, dialoguing with adults has served you pretty well in the work that you do now.
I guess you could say that. That's true.
Well, who are the people that in your life that were your North Stars?
I mean, I think in our family, we had now that I look back, I've always had a pretty big family, I suppose, more than 25 people. currently my family, between my mom and my brothers and my extended families, we're more than 50, and people say that's a big family. And I think my family has always been, because when you have 50 people in your family and everyone kind of live, you know, within the vicinity in the area, you feel like you have all these people around you who talk about different things and teach you about different things. So I would say my family, my uncles and my cousins, and yeah, my grandma was a big, big time person in my life. I spent a lot of times with her. And when I was growing up, she used to wake me up in the morning, prepare me for school. And that always stayed with me. And I wake up every day at 5 o'clock. And I think that's why, because she wakes me up so early in the morning, sometimes 4 to 5, getting ready to go to school in the morning. So as an adult, that's just who I am. I wake up very early in the morning.
What about her? Tell me about her. What was she like as a person?
Yeah, my grandma recently died last year. She was a lovely person. She was just super kind. She was just a good-hearted person. Yeah, my grandma, you know, I don't think she had an easy life. She had 6 kids. My grandma used to tell me and her were best friends, because everywhere I go, I was with her and she was with me. But she was just such a good-hearted person. She took care of people in her community. She was someone who volunteered and helped people. She was just a really, really good and decent person.
Yeah, I was lucky to have a grandmother like that in my life. I still carry her with me, even though she's been gone for years. Did you have to leave Haiti? Was it a hardship? Did you have to come, or did you choose to come?
Well, I don't think anybody chooses to leave a country, right? Nobody, and that's the thing. I remember when I was living in, England in 2012. Uh-huh. And it was around the time that England or the UK decided to give visas to a lot of people from Eastern Europe. And they did not come. And they felt very embarrassed by that, based on what I hear in the news at the time. And the point is that no matter how poor people are, they would prefer to stay with their families. They would not want to immigrate. People who immigrate oftentimes are people who it's the amount of structural stress from the countries why they leave. People don't just move to new countries unless they have a great job there, especially when you're thinking of when you come from places like Haiti. When someone move here, oftentimes, if they're a doctor, their license doesn't work here. If they're a lawyer, their license doesn't work here. There is a big language difference. So they have to learn a thing anew. It's a new culture. It's a new life. It's a new lifestyle. So, yeah, we moved from Haiti because of, you know, political violence in Haiti, economic issues. That's just been the story of Haiti for as long as I've known it. It's a country with a lot of sociopolitical and economic dysfunction that makes it very, very hard for people to live there.
Yeah, and a lot of that was
thrive.
A lot of that was imposed on them. Most of it was, because they were taken advantage of by colonizers, right? France, the United States. It has been hard, but being destabilized on a regular basis doesn't do much for a country.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, when you look at the southern border and you say, oh, people are just moving here, and it goes to your points. People are not just leaving their communities. There are a lot of geopolitics involved in that as well, too, right? And a lot of the things that we're seeing, they're not just on the surface, people just migrating. It's just economic policies from the United States that open the floodgates to corporations to destabilize countries' economies, and then you find themselves at the southern border.
So I've heard you say that you wanted to be a lawyer from a very early age because you saw injustice when growing up. Do you feel comfortable talking about the injustice that you saw as a young person?
You know, growing up in Haiti, the poverty that I saw around me, and the thing, too, when I think of the life that we led when we were there, I was not as poor as some of the other people that I had seen.
Right.
And I think that's that impression that was left on me, is that there were people who were much, much poorer with lesser privilege. And there were children just like me, and I couldn't explain why, right? I couldn't explain why a child is living on the street, but I have a place to stay. Yes. And I have parents and I have friends and I go to school, and they didn't go to school. And that's another thing too. In Haiti, not all children go to school. Not everyone has an education. So I think I saw that. And also, you know, hearing about people being murdered, the things that I was hearing, the political dysfunction, the economic dysfunction, also the tangible things that I would see with my own eyes. I think all these things impacted me in a way that I thought, I wanted to be part of the solution. You know, I didn't want to just wake up every day and stare at the sun and just live, you know, and because there is that, there is that. And there is a lot of that. Think about it, in a country where there is not, you know, there is so much turmoil, there is a lot of waking up and staring at the sun. And I wanted to do something different. I wanted to contribute in a way that I think could, I don't know. I know when you're a kid, you think, yeah, I think all by myself, I can change the world, right? But
right.
But I just thought I wanted to be part of the solutions. I wanted to make a difference.
I imagine in your life, you've had quite a few people just tell you can't do something. Tell me about that yes, I can attitude that you have, the si se puede. It's like, you know, I'm not going to stare at the sun. I'm going to try to do something for myself as well as for others. Where does that come from? Does that come from that village setting, that all your family around you?
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm trying to think that. I think that's a great question. I think no matter where you are in life, where you stand, you can always see that as a point of privilege. And I think, but when I really look at where I came from, I would say when you come from a place of deficit, you can only move forward, if that makes sense. You know, when we left Haiti and we come to this country, we had nothing. And when you have nothing, you can only progress. There are people who always make their situation worse, you know?
Right. Right.
But I just don't think in my case that I could have made it worse. I don't know why I can't do something. I mean, of course, there are things we can't do. I mean, I can't go and become an astronaut tomorrow, right, and study for it. I don't think I'll be able to sit still because I feel like there's so many other things I could go do, right?
Right.
But I think as a child, as a young person, you know, if you want to do something, you can. But I also want to reflect that, you know, being a lawyer, it took me trying more than once, right? Because I think a lot of times what people see is the person in front of the curtain. They see your arrival, but they don't know the experience of how you got there.
Right.
It took me a while before I become a lawyer. The first time I applied, you know, to go to school to university, I got into one university and it was $70,000 and I couldn't afford it. And I said, okay, maybe I won't go. Went to community college. And then I applied to the University of Florida, got in. And then I applied to law school a few times and I couldn't figure it out. It was too expensive. I set that aside, went and applied for a master's, got a scholarship, went and did that. Came back, applied again for law school, could not figure it out. And then when I was living in Central African Republic, I applied again.
Okay, hold on a second. You just outlined persistence with an underline, you know. Where did that come from? I couldn't get in this door. That didn't work. So I tried this door. But you never gave up and stared at the sun, like you said. Where does that come from in you?
I think one thing that I notice in myself, I can say, is that I do have a curiosity for life. I do have an imagination that even I don't know where that came from. I want to learn new things. I think that's really what that persistence is about. It's not I think it's something that I don't even understand, because there are times people say, oh, Junie, when I look at you and the things that you do, and it may not mesh. But for me, it's like, if this is not working, I'll try something new and I'll immerse myself in it and I'll enjoy it. Because to me, the learning and the journey is part of life. It's part of the experience. There's no need for me to sit here and just pout or cry about something that's not happening. I'm like, next.
Yeah.
And maybe you'll come back and maybe it'll work at a different time. And, you know, for instance, I teach now. I teach at a local university. And I remember there was a time that's all I wanted to do and that's all I wanted to figure out. And I applied and I applied and I applied and I couldn't figure it out. And now I'm doing it. So in life, things doesn't happen when we want. It happens when it happens. And sometimes it's best to let things happen naturally on its own and gradually. And I think that's been the beauty of my life journey, is that, you know, I can find myself lost somewhere and I continue to be lost and just keep going and I'll find new paths.
Well, and that's hope and that's faith. You're going, yeah, this will work out, you know, and not now, but, you know, I'm learning some things about it and it'll get better. Was that your parent? Your parents must have had a hand in that, or your village, the people that surrounded you. You weren't told all the time you couldn't do something. In fact, it sounds like it was fairly wide open for you. Am I wrong there? Or?
Yeah, I agree. I think definitely my parents, my mom had a hand in that. But I, like I said, I don't know. You know, sometimes you can't explain why you do certain things, right?
If you were
to put your own life under a microscope, you'd say, what is wrong with this person?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that powers the immigrant imagination is persistence. Mm-hmm. You know, I think people who have had to overcome that transition from one culture and one country to another, they bring with them a certain amount of persistence and hope that I think sometimes we Americans don't really have, these native-born folks. But
there's no need for it, though. I think that's maybe the difference, is that, like you said, if your life is a life of, you know, you get everything that you need when you need it, what's there, you know, resilience is for people who've gone through things, or people, you don't, you know, it's something, it's almost like it's an experience, right? It's by looking at your past experiences and you can say, okay, I was resilient, but if nothing happened in your life, then it is what it is. But I don't think there is anything as a perfect life either. I mean,
right.
Even
no.
People you may think that have not experienced anything have had experiences. That's what it means to be alive.
Exactly. So I stopped you when you were talking about, oh, and I ended up in Central African Republic. Tell me about that. That, talk about people having to stare at the sun.
Yeah, I end up in Central African Republic. I was an intern with the UN back in 2012, 2013, I believe. And after my internship, I also did a fellowship with them. And then I applied to work with them through their UNV program at the UN. And I did that for 1 year and I really enjoyed it. It was a great experience. But I was at a country in conflict, and and that really was, I mean, I am glad I did this experience, but I said, oh, if I had a child and my child was young, I'd say don't go, because it's one of those experiences where your life was constantly in danger, and it was a wonderful experience. I would not take a moment away from that, because, you know, when people say, you know, I've heard, you know, different people who believe in God or will say that, you know, heaven and hell is right here. And when I look at that experience, I said, oh, yeah. I understand when people say that, because that's an experience that very few people will understand, that level of, I mean, that's beyond poverty. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's turmoil.
That's beyond. That's like a level of not having, it's like, you know, you can't, I was like, is the word depravity? No, it's beyond that. It's like, there is nothing, but there's still people as well who are trying to live every day. And I remember when I was there, I was thinking to myself, look at me, I came from, you know, the US. Only if these people could imagine a world, that world, a world of possibility where life is so different. There's, you know what I mean? I mean, no one's killing me here. Nobody's chasing me, trying to murder me because I'm Black. I mean, I'm sure yes. there was a time Black people had that experience where they were constantly or consistently, what's the word, persecuted. But at this point in 2026, I don't have any of that fear. Yes. And when I was living in Central African Republic, that's what it was. It was, there were, it was, the conflict was between Christians and non-Christians and Muslims, and it was also an economic war. So there was no real political system in the country. There was no real, there was no rule of law, no administration. So it was a country in absolute chaos, and it was absolute hell.
On the verge of genocide too.
It was on the verge. Yes. At the time when I was there, there were conversation that they would, the UN could potentially classify it as a genocide, but I don't believe they did even after I left. But yeah, that's what it was. And I remember when I was living there and there were a couple of situations. And then I said, you know what? I really enjoy this work. I want to do it. And also, too, part of it was I was doing humanitarian work within a human rights context. And I had the human rights skills, but I needed to understand the humanitarian law context that I was in. And I said, I need to go back to law school to fully immerse myself into you. What rights people have, what obligation does the state has toward the citizenry? And that's why I came back to Boulder. I got into the law school. They gave me some money for a scholarship. And I said, you know what, I'll come to Boulder. And by the way, I looked at the flyer. I looked at it online and I said, oh, this is the heaven that I'm looking for.
You said that you felt like you had some, survivor guilt leaving there? That it was, things were so bad that you felt bad leaving there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yes, because the need was, it was so great there. Why do I have the right to leave? Yes. Why do I get to leave when these people are suffering? And the thing about it, when I looked at them, they did not look any different from me. There was no difference from between them and I. I just assumed, you know, the only difference is that I was born in the family that I was born, and by luck, I end up where I end up, and here I am, and somehow I get to leave, and they have to stay in that what seemed to be very much a hellish situation. And the word hellish in itself does not describe, it will not give it any of the real sense of horror that I experienced, or not that I experienced, that I saw,
that you saw
while
yes.
I was living there.
You did not turn your back. You decided, you were resolute. You came back to see if you couldn't get more skills so that you could help people in situations like that, which I think is why you have ended up as a representative. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I definitely did not want to stop doing the work. I think for me, everybody, you know, I often hear this in the Black community that, you know, having a calling or something that inspires you. I think public service is my calling. It's what I enjoy. I don't think there is, you know, I think people have things that drives them and that makes them want to wake up every day. And for me, it's just public service. I don't think there is any amount of money that would make me roll out of bed. There is not anything else that I can see that, you know, that inspires me to want to get up and get going and talk to people than public service. So I think when I came back to Boulder, I wanted to continue to do that. I did not want to just put my nose in the books and just forget about the world. I was not that interested. And I was also of an age where I thought, you know, you have to take on the responsibility of being human. You can't just be a student, you know, for the rest of your life. Yes, you're here, you want to learn more, and you're curious about the world, but can you do both at the same time?
And those are words spoken by a woman who has seen her share of dismantling that we don't want to happen here, you know, what has been done to Haiti, what has been done to the Central African Republic cannot happen here. We cannot allow it.
I agree, Walter, and I appreciate you saying that, and that's the very reason why I do this work, because I have seen what the lack of rule of law look like, right? The lack of political administration look like. I have seen it, and I've seen, and the thing about these countries, by the way, that I've noticed is that whether it's Haiti or Central African Republic or Cote d'Ivoire, all these countries that I've traveled to, one thing that I've seen consistently with them, they have an upper ruling class that has everything.
Everything.
They are the multimillionaires and multi-billionaires. And then you have a majority working class that have absolutely nothing. And that's why I do this work, because I know if we allow this country or communities to be communities where you have the 1% that has everything, and then you have the majority that has nothing, this country will fall in absolute and utter chaos.
That was Colorado Representative Junie Joseph, who wakes up early every morning, like her grandmother taught her, and goes to work building Colorado communities where everyone has access to their inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. She is currently sponsoring 23 bills in the Colorado House's 2026 regular session with that very goal in mind. You've been listening to the Immigrant Stories program. To learn more about immigrant stories or to listen to past stories, you can go to immigrantstories.net or to the Immigrant Stories Facebook page or to your favorite radio station, kdnk.org. You can also find us as a podcast on Apple and Spotify. Special thanks to Junie Joseph for her tireless commitment to the preservation of our democracy. Her grandmother would be very proud. Thanks for listening.